Hello? 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 Anyone there? Oh, there. Hey. How you doing? Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this podcast, we highlight people's stories. We celebrate your successes. And together, we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. Well done. You are listening to the second episode of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Monday, July 25th, 2016. First off, thank you to the many people who listened to last month's show. I have been happily blown away by your emails, tweets, and voicemails. You can always contact me with your feedback, ideas, successes, dilemmas, and answers to our monthly Citizens Climate Puzzler. My email is radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Before the end of the show, I'll say that email address again, along with the phone number where you can leave me a voicemail or send me a text. I have designed today's program for you in three parts. First, in our main section, I explore a popular talking point used to motivate people to climate action. We often hear the appeal, we need to act for the children and the grandchildren. We must do something immediately for the benefit of future generations. Powerful stuff. But does it work? And what do the children and the grandchildren have to say about it? We will look at this and much more. Next, we will head into the art house, where you will meet a professor of ecology who is also a poet. Lilis Mellon-Guignard talks about the role of art. As a parent, she also reflects on parenting in a time of climate change. Finally, we hear your answers to last month's puzzler question. So many great answers. I share some of them and even have an expert weigh in. Then I will tell you about this month's Citizens Climate Puzzler. So, you ready for the show? Here we go. Back in 2012, I grew alarmed about climate change. Obviously, I had been aware, but one day something clicked for me. It was like I had been in a sleeper cell. Suddenly, the right words jarred me awake. I became activated. Of course, many messages build up to lead to that magical moment. I imagine a lot of us have had that epiphany when we almost instantly become aware and alarmed. In fact, a lot of climate communication tries to land on just the right words and talking points that will wake people up. One of the most common attempts sounds something like this. Climate change is serious. We need to think of the children. We need to act right now so that our children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren do not inherit a broken planet. I know this approach has moved many people deeply. I hear their testimonies about their own conversion experiences that led them to climate groups and climate actions. When it comes to climate communications, though, there is no silver bullet. While this talking point has deepened the commitment from already eco-conscious parents and grandparents, this one actually bounced right off me. I mean, I have nothing against kids. Some of my best friends have kids. But when it comes to talking about climate, I literally have no personal DNA in the game. I don't have children or the prospect of grandchildren. And while I am not insensitive to the children around me, the appeal to future generations doesn't move me in the same way as it might for people with their own offspring. But there is another possible problem in focusing on future generations. It could give us the impression that climate change still hasn't happened, but will eventually raise its ugly head sometime down the road. In highlighting the problem of CO2 and our atmosphere, the president made it clear, quote, "This generation has altered the composition of the atmosphere on a global scale through a steady increase in carbon dioxide from the burning of fossil fuels." This pronouncement was followed up with a chilling statement from the National Research Council. "We now understand that industrial waste such as carbon dioxide released during the burning of fossil fuels can have consequences for climate that pose a considerable threat to future society. The scientific problems are formidable, the technical problems unprecedented, and the potential economic and social impacts ominous. Now that sounds to me like a call to immediate action, to provide stability for Earthlings present and future alike. And if those statements I just read sound like more of the same global warming jibber-jabber we heard in the build-up to last year's big Paris Climate Summit, here's something that will put it into perspective. That U.S. president I quoted who raised the climate alarm was not Barack Obama. It wasn't either of the Bush presidents. It wasn't Bill Clinton or Jimmy Carter. That call to climate action actually came from President Lyndon B. Johnson, speaking in 1965. The National Research Council then took it a step further in 1971 with that follow-up statement released during the Nixon administration. So, exactly who are these children, grandchildren, and great-grandchildren who are doomed to inherit a dysfunctional Earth and atmosphere unless we do something to fix it? Yeah, that would be me, and most of you listening. As the old song goes, we are the world, we are the children. So I decided to talk to some of the children born since 1965. I wanted to hear about their own experiences with pollution and climate change. I needed to learn what these children and grandchildren are saying and doing. Meet Piper Christian. Piper is a 16-year-old high school student from Logan, Utah, who will enter the 11th grade this fall. She and some of her friends have jumped onto the climate action train. What does that mean? She is active in her local Citizens Climate Lobby chapter. In June this year, she spoke on a youth panel at the CCL International Conference in DC. And in November 2015, she traveled to Paris, France, for the historic climate summit. I asked her about her own experience of waking up to the dangers of climate change, along with the realization that she has a part to play on this changing planet. This 16-year-old told me a story of a young person, even younger than Piper, who inspired and challenged her.
For me, it was actually a 15-year-old girl from Bali named Malati. I met her at the climate summit. She told me that when she was 12 years old, she was devastated because the islands of her home were being choked by plastic bags. And so, as a 12-year-old, inspired by the nonviolent resistance of Gandhi, she went on a hunger strike, which convinced her government to ban plastic bags. What I saw from that is I had come to the summit with still a pretty big sense of hopelessness and feeling like as an individual, or a citizen, there's not much I can do. And then here I meet this humble 12-year-old girl that changed a nation. And it made me realize that not only do citizens have power, but also that when we reach out to youth and when we get them involved, we can accomplish miraculous things.
Piper is from Utah. I'm not sure what image you have of Utah, but I've taken the train through this beautiful U.S. state, and I see majestic mountains, wide open spaces, and so much nature. No surprise, living in Cache Valley, Utah, Piper spends a lot of time outside in nature. But it isn't always pleasant.
I grew up on a canoe, on a bike, you know, in canyons and on rivers, and experiencing wildlife. Just have such a love for my valley and my home because we live in this mountain valley. At the same time, because of the car pollution and agriculture, we have some of the worst air pollution in the country during the winters. I mean, I grew up not being able to go outside for recess because it would hurt our lungs. Kids would have coughs if they ran outside for too long. Even in high school, we don't have access to the track during the winter because it could cause exercise-induced asthma. I think that's what made me realize that it's affecting people at the personal level. And then going to the International Climate Summit and just talking to people who at the community level are just facing these hardships. And that's what really brought me in at the personal level was not just this kind of abstract, oh, we have this global climate crisis, but seeing my own community hurt and then talking face to face with people who had similar trials and realizing this almost global family with this common problem.
Piper shared with me good news about how youth are organizing in her community and globally. At a regional gathering for citizen volunteers advocating climate solutions, Piper saw firsthand the enthusiasm and commitment of her peers.
After everyone went home, those kids stayed after the meeting. We were just so encouraged and excited about this cause that we thought we need to create a youth network around our state and start supporting each other. And we've stayed in touch and prepared a lot for this conference. So, I mean, that just touches upon just globally and also locally the way youth have just so much initiative.
Having all these young people engaged in climate advocacy gives me great hope. I mean, it's one thing to appeal to adults to act on behalf of future generations. It is quite another when a young person comes face to face with an adult, be they a parent or a lawmaker, and says, "I need you to consider my future and what we can do to keep this world safe and stable." Here's an example. In a U.S. federal court, 21 youth plaintiffs ages 8 to 19 are attempting to sue the U.S. government and the fossil fuel industry on behalf of their own futures and future generations. According to Forbes magazine, quote, "The lawsuit alleges that the federal government is violating the plaintiffs' constitutional and public trust rights by promoting the use of fossil fuels." The complaint explains that for over 50 years, the U.S. government and the fossil fuel industry have known that carbon dioxide from burning fossil fuels causes global warming and dangerous climate change, and that continuing to burn fossil fuels destabilizes the climate system. Now, after the lawsuit was introduced by the youth, the U.S. government and the fossil fuel industry attempted to block the motion and dismiss the lawsuit. But after hearing the young people's case and seeing them in the courtroom, the judge ruled in favor of the youth, so the lawsuit will proceed. Yes, adults, considering the needs and lives of future generations can be powerful motivation to act, but as Piper explains, having youth involved in the process is essential. So I asked Piper about the magical climate talking point. We need to pursue climate solutions on behalf of the children and the grandchildren. As one of these children, she offered the following advice.
And while this is so valuable, I think we may be missing the point, because this is not about working for kids. This is about working with kids, because we have to give us opportunities to demonstrate the leadership that we'll need when you guys are gone.
This is not about working for kids, but working with kids. Yes, Piper, I hear that loud and clear. In my quest to learn from children affected by fossil fuel pollution and climate change, I spoke with a woman who, as a girl growing up in China, encountered extreme levels of pollution. Meet Clara Fang. Clara is a 33-year-old with many accomplishments under her belt. Her degrees include a Master of Environmental Management from Yale and a Master of Fine Art and Creative Writing from the University of Utah. A creative writer who is also a climate advocate, Clara now lives in Pennsylvania. She is active in a variety of groups that seek to make the world a better place. Her own personal story, in large part, influences her engagement in the world today. At age 9, she and her family left China and came to the USA into a whole new environment.
As a child in China, I lived in an environment where there was a lot of pollution and really not much nature. I'm from Shanghai, which is very urban, and I really thought that was the entire world. You know, I've never taken a trip to a forest or a beach or anything. And then I came here and I was in a suburban environment, but it was still so astonishing to me, like the amount of nature that we have in this country. Like, I had never seen a blue sky until I came here.
Clara's American teachers were passionate about bringing children into nature. As a binational person, she quickly developed a sense of the wider world and her connection to it.
I think a lot of people, they really see where they're from as a part of their identity, or where they're living, their community as part of their identity. And when you're someone who has moved around a lot and has lived in very different cultures, you can't so much attached to any culture. And I really get the sense of the earth as being our community, and that the commonalities are greater than the differences. And wherever we go, it's really the earth, the ecology, the biology, which is where we all come from.
Clara was concerned about pollution that was changing the weather so dramatically, but at times she felt powerless and hopeless.
It was easy to be cynical about what's going on in government and to feel kind of hopeless about how to solve this huge problem when you're just this little individual.
Clara began to question the approach that she had always been taught. This is a big problem that requires big solutions.
And I think a lot of the emphasis in the environmental movement has been on individual behavior change. More and more over time, you know, just realize how that's not enough. And we need to act collectively, and we need to have systems change.
For Clara, that meant getting into U.S. congressional offices to lobby for a price on carbon so that people have to pay for the right to pollute.
Carbon fee and dividend is a systems change, and acting at the level of national and international legislation has the power to affect everyone, you know, and that's what I think we really need. So I'm really glad to be a part of it.
I want to bring one more voice into this discussion of climate action for the children and for future generations. Meet Kathy Orlando. Kathy is from Canada. She was born in 1966, a year after U.S. President Lyndon B. Johnson raised concern about carbon dioxide pollution altering the Earth's atmosphere. Kathy, along with her husband and three daughters, lives in Toronto. As the National Director for Citizens Climate Lobby Canada, Kathy works full-time advocating for climate solutions. She meets regularly with members of Parliament and organizes citizen volunteers all over Canada. Kathy explained to me how her childhood shaped her. She grew up in the late 1970s, early 80s, very close to the U.S. border. And as a child, pollution, and one woman's response to it, played a powerful role in how she sees the world today, 40 years later.
I grew up in Niagara Falls. That's Niagara Falls, Canada. And we got mostly USA News. So I was 9, 10, 11 years old when Lois Gibbs led the fight at Loudoun Canal. And I watched the news with my mother. My mother always watched the news. That was our thing.
For over 40 years, Hooker Chemical Corporation dumped over 80 toxic substances at Love Canal. And the poisons are now seeping into the homes built over the deposit site.
Well, we have got abnormalities in our chromosomes, and we've known it all along that on our street alone there has been already 8 cases of cancer on a 15-house street.
I learned from Lois Gibbs, governments and corporations don't take care of people. People take care of people. So it's up to us. That was a big lesson for me.
As a young adult, Kathy decided she needed to do something significant to address environmental issues. This drive influenced her studies.
I went to university, studied science, not because I loved it, but I felt that somebody who was going to becoming a responsible, wise age in the 21st century, so this was back in the 80s, I needed a science education for what was coming.
Kathy then did what many college graduates do. She lived her life, found employment, and settled down into family life. But then something happened that jarred her awake to the reality of the world around her.
And then in 2007, I got pregnant at age 40. I was listening to the radio. I was working from home, and I heard on the radio the summary report for the fourth report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and I was very pregnant, and I heard that if we keep doing what we're doing, this planet was going to be a very difficult place to live on 40 years from now. I saw everything, every gain every woman has ever made in their life dissolve. In my mind, this climate change will just rip apart our society. And I have three daughters. This was my third one I was pregnant with, and I made a huge commitment to her. I was going to do whatever I could.
Now, what sort of response matches the intensity of a concern like this? We often feel the need to connect with others who carry a similar burden. In Kathy's case, she joined Al Gore's organization. In 1 year, she gave over 100 presentations in hopes of waking people up to the dangers of fossil fuel pollution. But even among those who were concerned about climate change, she grew exasperated by what already started to sound like defeat. At a training session for climate communicators, she blew up.
I think I was a little sassy because everybody was whiny. Because people were saying, we can't, the corporations, you know, the whole wah, wah, wah. I was like, why are you here? Why are you here? This problem is solvable. We just got to unite. This is solvable. It's just all we lack is political will. I even knew it then. The politicians needed our help.
The politicians needed our help. And for a time, things seemed to be moving in a positive direction in the Canadian government. A pro-climate bill was introduced in the Senate. Kathy believed her lawmakers would do the right thing and act on behalf of the people and the climate.
Fast forward to November 2010, we had a pretty promising climate bill go through our lower house, and it got killed in the Senate. First bill in over 90 years to get killed in the Senate. It was devastating.
Perhaps it was in part the influence of women like Lois Gibbs during Kathy's childhood, who provided an example of a fearless, relentless advocate for change. Likely it has something to do with Kathy's own relentlessness. Instead of running away from the fight, Kathy pressed in further.
And I went and spoke with my minister, two Native elders, and made the decision to quit my job and do this full time until something was real could happen.
I ended my interview with Kathy Orlando by asking a question about the future and her legacy. I asked her to imagine her 80th birthday. Imagine the efforts of countless volunteer advocates that paid off. Canada and the rest of the world heard the voices of citizens and responded with meaningful policy change that led to a dramatic transformation in how we get our energy. We were not out of the water, but emissions dropped and a great transition from fossil fuel pollution to alternative energy sources occurred. At her 80th birthday, she is being honored for her many efforts as a climate action figure. Her youngest daughter comes to the podium to say a few words about her mother and the many ways she contributed to changing the world around her. I ask Kathy, what might your daughter say?
She did this for me. She already knows that. When we had our first conference in Canada, it was really stressful because we have no money, Like, we're doing this all on a dream. Anyways, I had this breakout room, little cloak room, that I would go hide in just to get myself together. She was only 5 years old, 6 years old at the time, and she ran into the cloak room, climbed up on my lap, and pulled my face and said, "You're doing this for me, aren't you, Mommy?" She already knows. She knows. So I did it for her, did it for all the children.
Thank you to Kathy Orlando, Clara Fang, and Piper Christian for sharing your thoughts with us. And before we head into the art house, I want to share one more thing that Clara told me about poetry. She is a poet herself, and when we spoke about China, climate change, and collective action, she shared some thoughts about the role of the poet.
Poetry helps us process the experiences that we have around us. When I read poetry, it's so striking to me because it really digs at, you know, why we're here, why we want to be here, and that we can find so much joy and so much connection in the midst of a lot of chaos. I find that poetry really brings that, and it reminds us of what it means to be human.
And now it's time for the art house. In the art house today, we hear from poet Lilis Mellon Guignard. Lilis is a wonderful hybrid of a professor who has taught ecology, creative writing, women's studies, and rock climbing. She lives with her husband and two children in rural Pennsylvania, where she teaches at Mansfield University. Her work has recently appeared in Poetry Magazine. Lilis and I recently spoke. She says she enjoys rock climbing and biking with her husband, eavesdropping on her children and shaking things up in adult Sunday school. She also told me that being a parent in a time of rapid climate change has affected her outlook and her poetry.
But when I had my children, and that was a little later in life, so I'd done all this work and I'd been an environmental writer and taught environmental studies, but it changed the way I wrote, looked at the world and wrote about things and felt the immediacy of not just what do I do, but how do I prepare my children to live a happy life in whatever comes? And so that really started taking my poetry in a different direction, and I think renewed focus of how do we raise children in a time of climate change?
Wow, what a question. How do we raise children in a time of climate change? Lilith responded to that question with a poem. It is a type of poem known as a villanelle. It has 19 lines with two repeating rhymes and two refrains. You don't really need to know that to enjoy the poem. It was published in 2013 in the anthology Facing the Change, Personal Encounters with Global Warming, which is available at Torrey House Press. The idea for the poem came to Lilith while walking with her son. He was 2.5 or 3 years old at the time. Lilith sets the scene for us and then reads the poem, Darkness.
He had on his new Thomas the Train shoes, and nowadays shoes blink. They have little lights in them. And it was fall, and we had just hit that point where it was twilight enough at the 5 o'clock mark when we were walking home that he could see these new shoes blink. And so that's where this came from. The first line is a quote, and it's his line, and I heard iambic pentameter, and that line haunted me. Oh, I should also say that this was written shortly thereafter Hurricane Katrina. The darkness. I can make the dark not dark anymore. His shoes blink red lights against the pavement. My son's hand in mine, his night steps are sure. Such confidence, such trust. Just what's in store for those unaware their future's been spent. I can make the dark not dark anymore. He thinks it's easy. Tell that to the poor folks unhomed by hurricane and president. My son's hand in mine, his night steps are sure. It's hard to keep my faith strong at the core when I know how bad the earth has been bent to make the dark not dark anymore, the hot more cold and cold more hot. Ignored consequences creep up with a vengeance. My son's hand in mine, his night steps are sure that I'm in charge. How to prepare him for how progress turned to global accident. I can't make the dark not dark anymore, my son. Hand in mine, your night steps sure.
Thank you, Lilith Mellon-Guignard, for that lovely poem, Darkness. You can read it for yourself in the anthology Facing the Change, Personal Encounters with Global Warming, available at Torrey House Press. Do you want to discover more of Lilith's writing? Visit her blog, A Tent of One's Own, www.tentofonesown.com. No caps, no spaces, tentofonesown.com. And for more of her poetry that explores parenting in a time of climate change, Lilith has a chapbook that just came out. The award-winning short book of poetry, Young at the Time of Letting Go, is available through Evening Street Press. I welcome your ideas for the Art House. Send suggestions to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Poetry, music, comedy, theater, art is an essential part of our climate communication. We have come to the third and final section of our program, the Citizens Climate Puzzler. Last month, I introduced you to Claire, who at a party expressed her concern about climate change. She then added, "But I really think there are much more pressing issues that we need to address." I asked, "How might you respond to Claire in a way that opens up the conversation? See if you can offer an answer that affirms Claire while getting her closer to climate change." Well, I received so many emails and voicemails with answers to the puzzler, and honestly, I can say they were all really helpful and insightful. I also saw a theme emerge in many of them. So first, thanks for the many responses from all over the place. Liz Fisher in California, Andres Forno in Chile, Ryan and Frankie in Tennessee, Paul Thompson in the Twin Cities, Vicky Paul in American Samoa, Sabrina Fu in Maryland, Sid Madison in New Jersey, and a lot more. Thanks for all the voicemails and the emails. So, how do we respond to Claire, who's concerned but thinks there are bigger fish to fry? John Whitmer wrote, quote, "You're right, Claire. We need to address many serious issues, and we should press on as many as we can. What issues top your priority list?" So John suggests we answer with a question and get to know a little bit more about Claire and what she's concerned about. One response from Down Under does something similar.
"Hi, Peterson. This is Rod Mitchell from CCL Australia. My response to Claire would be, that's really interesting, Claire. Please tell me what they are. I'd love to know. Then we can discuss whatever she comes up with."
Expanding on these answers, Madeline Pera, the program director for Citizens Climate Lobby, explains.
"I would first want to find out what seems most important to them, you know, and come back with a question. You know, it's like, so what, you know, what are your most urgent issues? And listen to that a little bit, because there are a lot of things that people care about that are urgent besides climate. And then I think I would like to see if we can make a link. Maybe ask that question, can you see anything, any common ground between what I'm caring about with the climate that seems so urgent and what you are? What are the connections between our issues?"
It seems like we're getting a consensus here. And I know this might seem like basic information for some people, but I actually turned to an expert who said that these responses that you're hearing are not the typical ones. I spoke with Dr. Jo Huxter. She is a postdoctoral research fellow at Bucknell University. As an environmental studies scholar, she surprised me by saying that she actually works in the philosophy department. She studies the public understanding of climate change science. Jo confirms that with these answers that you're hearing, we're on the right track and that research backs up your answers.
Claire's response is incredibly common. It's the kind of thing that you hear almost all the time. For a lot of us, our first instinct is to get sort of angry or to immediately, I want anyway, to immediately yell at Claire and say, how can you not think this is the most important thing that's coming our way right now? And what you may have noticed and what psychological research backs up is that this kind of response is actually more likely to alienate Claire than to bring her on your side. The more forceful your response is, the more likely it is that she's going to back up or even entrench herself further and try to fight against you. The first way that you can combat this or deal with this type of response is to start with something we call a grain of truth. And that is acknowledging something in what Claire said that you think rings true with you. And this can be really hard given some of the responses you can get. But with Claire, it's not too difficult to say, oh, wow, there are so many big things going on right now. Take so much of our attention, aren't there? By doing that, what you've done is sort of put yourself in her shoes and you've shown her that you heard what she said and you're listening to her. Then you can maybe ask Claire what kinds of things it is that she is concerned about, those things that she thinks are a bigger issue than climate change. You can actually then relate that or tie it back to climate change in some way. You can bring in how climate change may affect or exacerbate whatever it is that she finds most worrying at the time. You have shown her that you're listening to her, and then you've done something called framing, which is where you have made something that she cares about pertinent to climate change, or made climate change pertinent to something she cares about, which connects it personally to her and may help her at least see why you think climate change is a big issue.
Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Madeline. And thanks to everyone who answered last month's puzzler. So, are you ready for the new puzzler? I'll give you the contact details in a moment, including the voicemail line. Okay. We know that bringing up climate change in conversation can stir up feelings of guilt and shame. Some people even grow defensive. Yet others highlight all that they're already doing to be better citizens and consumers. Now imagine you were chatting with someone while traveling somewhere. On a bus, train, plane, camel, however you travel with others. You reveal to this person that you are concerned about climate change. You say you are pursuing a variety of solutions. The person you are speaking with, let's call him Sven, replies, "I could not agree more. In fact, I am doing so much to address global warming. I recycle, take shorter showers, ride my bike to work, and I have become a vegan. If we each would just do our own part, we will tackle this problem." Okay, so what do you think about Sven's response? Is he correct to assume that if enough people change their individual consumption habits, we will tackle this problem? He clearly cares about addressing climate change and is putting lots of effort into cleaning up his personal lifestyle. How would you answer Sven? Send me your answers. Leave your name, contact info, and where you are from. Get back to me by August 15th, 2016. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Or call me, text me, and leave a voicemail at 570-483-8194. That's 570-483-8194. I promise I will respond to all your messages. Thank you for listening to this second episode of Citizens Climate Radio. Be sure to share this show with your friends. Just look for Citizens Climate Lobby on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher Radio. We also have a Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/Citizens Climate Radio. The show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. We had audio technical assistance from Chris Pellucci over at MediaVolution. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Mortarano and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera and Liz Fisher. Additional thanks to Chris Weingard, Glenn Retief, and Joanna Huckster. Special thanks to Dr. Naomi Oreskes for those quotes from President LBJ and from the Nixon administration. These appear in Dr. Oreskes' book, Merchants of Doubt. Oh, and thanks to Abaya Thiel for this lovely message.
This is Abaya from Gainesville, Florida. Holy socks. That was terrific. I laughed. I cried. I'm still crying. Thank you so much for Citizens Climate Radio. I love it, and I love you all. I'm going to listen to the first episode again, and then I'm going to share it as widely as I can. So thank you all.
And thank you, Ellie Sparks, for this message.
I just listened to your radio show. It's so beautiful. Thank you so much. I just wish it was weekly instead of monthly. I don't know if I can hold on until next month.
I hear you would like more Citizens Climate Radio. While I cannot commit to a weekly program, I decided to make the monthly show a little bit longer for you. Feel free to leave me a voicemail telling me what you think of the program, offer suggestions, or just say hi. The voicemail line again is 570-483-8194. That's 570-483-8194. 94. And that number is a U.S. number, so plus one before it if you're calling outside the United States. You can text me at that number too, or email me radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. All of the music we use on the show is licensed unless otherwise specified. Special music for the Art House segment includes one suite from the free 1920s collection on archive.org. Please rate our show on the iTunes channel, Citizens Climate Lobby. This will help us find more listeners looking for hope and fresh ideas about climate communication. Visit citizensclimate.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links and contact information. An easy way to share the show is to get a link to it over at ccl.podbean.com. On the right, you will see Citizens Climate Radio listed under categories. That's ccl.podbean.com. Bean, like vanilla bean. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education. Thank you for being part of the conversation. I look forward to hearing from you.
Awesome. Just a couple of logistical questions. So you're in high school or you're in college?
I'm going to be a sophomore, that's when we rewind. Right. I'm going to be a junior in high school. I'm 16 years old.
Oh, and you've already been to Paris and for the climate summit and everything.
It was just one of those fluke opportunities kind of, and it'd been a lifelong passion, and
so, anyways, afterwards, Marshall came up to me and said, I really like your style, and can I have your business card? And at that point, it was all out of business cards, and I said, you're going to have to Google me. So he Googled me, because I was working at a university, and he found my phone number and email, and he called me, and then I was really embarrassed that this really stately older gentleman actually took the time to Google me, so I Googled him back.
All right. Episode number 2, not bad. The music's kind of jaunty for me. I like it a little mellower, but overall, it's working for me.